Thanks. I called the talk Topological Quantum Computing for Beginners because I've been teaching a course this spring at Caltech on fault-tolerant quantum computing, and I decided to do the last six lectures on computing with non-abelian anyons. And actually, there are lecture notes for all but the last lecture, which I just gave last Thursday, which are on the course website. I'll add the other one next week, probably, which you can look at if you're interested. The easiest way to find it is to Google me. I'm the only John Fresco in the universe, I think, so it's easy to find. Of course, it's rather late in this workshop to be talking about topological quantum computing for beginners. A lot of you are experts by now, especially after the last couple of topological weeks. Two of the heroes of this subject are Alexei Kataev and Mike Friedman. Of course, we heard from Mike earlier today, and Alexei was here and gave a talk just last week. And I sense that there's a lot of interest on the part of the condensed matter community, or a segment of the condensed matter community, in the ideas that these guys have initiated, but still perhaps a lack of complete understanding about exactly what it was that these guys did anyway. And so that's what I'm going to try to explain in my talk. It'll be a pedagogical talk because I'm still in this pedagogical gear that I've been in from teaching my course, which means I'm not going to talk very much about my own work. I originally put in many gratuitous references to my own papers, but wound up dropping them just to save time. So another one of my favorite web resources is, well, so let me just make this comment first. The Kataev really pioneered the idea of using non-abelian anyons for fault-tolerant computing in 97, and the idea was elaborated a little bit and recently has been generalized by work by Carlos Michon, a Caltech graduate student. Friedman, Wang, and their collaborators use a somewhat more general approach to anyons in their work in 2000, and that turns out to be valuable because it leads you to simpler models that might be easier to implement ultimately than the ideas that Kataev originally had. So when I talk about Mike Friedman, I really mean the Friedman of 4 years ago before his remarkable metamorphosis into a condensed matter physicist. So to decide exactly what I should cover, I went to another one of my favorite web resources, which is the ITP website, and found my abstract. But I realized this weekend it was much too ambitious. I was going to talk about do a review of fault-tolerant computing, and I was going to talk about using abelian anyons for topological memory and using fluxons for computing and stuff, but I've dropped all that to make it more focused. I'm going to talk about the general theory of anyons and a particular example where we can see how universal quantum computation can be done with anyons. But we should be reminded of why we're so interested in this subject. There's this emerging field of quantum information science, and a lot of the excitement is driven by the hope that quantum weirdness can be more than just something marvelous and fascinating, but something we can actually put to work to perform tasks that wouldn't be possible in a classical world. And one of the exciting ideas is quantum computing, the idea that a computer that processes quantum states instead of classical bits would be able to perform tasks that would not be possible in a classical world. Most famously, this factoring problem is very hard for classical computers, but for a quantum computer, it would not be a hard problem, really not much harder than multiplying two numbers together to find their product. In fact, it might be helpful to remind ourselves what we can think of as the mathematical model of a quantum computer that this subject is about. The model really has five components. First of all, there's a big Hilbert space, which is the arena in which a computation takes place. But importantly, it's more than just a big Hilbert space. It has some natural decomposition into small subsystems like qubits. And that decomposition is really important because it gives us a natural notion of complexity. There are some operations that are easy to perform, the ones that just act on one or a couple of qubits, and we want to build from those more complicated collective operations, and that gives us a way of distinguishing hard computations from easy ones. There's also an initial state that we can choose to initialize our computer, which we can choose to be some standard state. And then we do a quantum circuit, which is just a sequence of unitary transformations, each one acting on just a small number of qubits, like let's say on 2 qubits, and those gates are chosen from some finite alphabet of unitary transformations, and they have the important property of being universal, which means by putting them together in a circuit, we can get an arbitrarily good approximation to any unitary transformation acting on n qubits. And a nice feature of the theory is it doesn't matter exactly, at least for classifying complexity, how we choose that universal gate set. I can efficiently simulate your universal gate set with mine and vice versa, so we agree on which computations are hard and which are easy. There's a classical computer that controls the quantum circuit that decides what quantum gate we should apply in the next time step. And then at the end, we have to read out a result of the computation, which will just be classical information that we can write down, so we measure some qubits in a standard basis to get the result. So that's the complete model of what a quantum computer is, and everything that it does is things that classical computers can simulate. It's really just multiplying together matrices, and in the end it has a random number generator, let's suppose, to simulate the quantum measurement process. So it can't compute anything that a classical computer isn't able to compute. But it can do certain computations much more efficiently, and the reason is that these matrices that it's manipulating are of exponential size, and we don't know a way to simulate that classically without exponential resources. And that's why a quantum computer can be capable of solving problems efficiently that classical computers can't. And another major theme of quantum information science is quantum error correction, which is very important for future quantum technologies. It's the idea that quantum information, if we encode it cleverly, can be protected from damage and processed reliably even with imperfect hardware. We know a quantum computer, however we make it, will not be perfectly isolated from its environment, and interactions with the environment will cause decoherence, that is, decay of the information carried by the machine, and that'll lead to errors. So it's only because we've learned that in principle we can use quantum error correction to fight off the destructive effects of decoherence and other possible sources of error that we have some confidence that large-scale quantum computers can really someday be built and operated. But I'm not going to talk about the theory of quantum fault tolerance. That was the subject of my course. Yeah, I'll just try to give you a little of the flavor of it with this analogy. Here are two information processing systems. How are they different from one another? Well, the one on the left, it's built from imperfect hardware, and in order for it to do anything interesting at all, it has to incorporate into its design a very complicated hierarchy of error correction mechanisms on many scales from the DNA on up. And the system on the right is built from much more reliable hardware, and as a result, error correction isn't so essential an element of its design and operation. Well, in some ways, it may turn out a quantum computer is more like System A than System B, in that a lot of the information processing, most of the information processing that it does, is for the purpose of preventing information from being lost to fight off decoherence instead of propelling the computation forward to the next step. It would always be preferable, if we can find a way of doing it, of getting a more robust machine, not through clever software, but through building more robust hardware, and that's where topological ideas come in. Topological properties of an object, of course, are the properties that remain invariant when we smoothly deform the object. And likewise, we'd like to find an implementation of a quantum gate that has the property that its action on the encoded information remains invariant when we deform the gate by introducing some noise. And so these guys envisioned a topological quantum computer, which in its basic operation works like this. We have a two-dimensional system. We make a bunch of pairs of particles, which are non-abelian anions. We perform a computation by executing a certain braid, performing exchanges of the particles, and then at the end we bring them together in pairs and observe whether they annihilate completely or not, and that's how we read out the result. And the advantage is, which is what I'm going to try to explain in the talk, is that the information is really physically robust. It's intrinsically protected from decoherence, which makes this an especially nice implementation of quantum computing. So, I have to explain to begin with what I mean by non-abelian anions. What's a model of anions? We're going to be talking about a two-dimensional system with a mass gap where the particles carry locally conserved charges. So we first of all specify some finite set of labels that we can attach to particles. We can imagine, just for convenience, that the particles are all laid out in some sequential order on a line in our plane. And the labels represent the different values of the conserved charge that a particle can carry. If a particle is perfectly isolated or very well isolated from other particles, its label is never going to change because there's a conservation law. There's a special label, zero, which just means the trivial charge. And there's a charge conjugation operation on the labels which associates with each charge the charge of its antiparticle. The model also has rules for fusing, which tell us the possible values of the charge that we can get, the possible labels when we combine two particles, and rules for braiding, which tell us the effects of exchanges of neighboring particles on the line, and also tell us what happens when we rotate one of the particles by 2 pi. And so let's talk more about fusion. There are some fusion rules which tell us the possible values of the charge C that can occur when we put A and B together. So if this integer NABC is greater than zero, that means C is a possible value of the charge that can occur when A and B are combined. But it might be this integer NABC is an integer greater than one. And what that means is that there's more than one distinguishable way to get C when you put an A and a B together. And there's some vector space, a Hilbert space, that describes, or which is spanned by those distinguishable ways. And we can choose a basis for that Hilbert space, which I've indicated here. These are the different ways of bringing A and B together to get a C, corresponding to orthogonal states in this fusion space labeled by an index mu. And if I want to, I can change the direction of the arrows in the picture and at the same time replace a label by its conjugate label. And that just reflects that there are a lot of isomorphisms among these spaces. If all the lines are going in, that represents the vector space spanned by the different distinguishable ways in which I can put together an A, a B, and a C bar to get the trivial charge. What's special about the charge zero is that it fuses trivially. I put it together with something, it doesn't change the label. And using this isomorphism, that's equivalent to saying that for each charge A, there's a unique conjugate charge which can be fused together with A to give zero, and in just a unique way. Now, when we say a model of anions is non-abelian, what we mean by that is that there's at least some pair of particles A and B which can fuse in at least two distinguishable ways, such that the vector space describing all the ways that they can fuse is at least two-dimensional. I'll call that a topological Hilbert space. And it's something that we can use to encode non-trivial quantum information. But it's really a non-local encoding of the information. The quantum information isn't localized on one of the particles or the other. It's a collective property of the pair of particles. So if I have particles with labels A and B, which are far apart from one another, local observers can't tell which state in this fusion space we have. If they go up and look at particle A, they can see it's an A, but they don't know anything about how it's glued together with particle B. And that's why the quantum states are invulnerable to decoherence due to local interactions with the environment. The environment can't see the difference between these different states in the fusion space, and that's why we propose to use this encoding of information in a quantum computer. Of course, if we hide quantum information from the environment, we're hiding it from ourselves too. But in this case, when we're ready to read out the quantum state, there's a way in which we can make it visible by fusing the particles together. We bring the two particles together, and then we observe whether the charge of the combined object, well, we observe what its charge is. And in fact, for simulating a universal quantum computer, it will suffice to be able to tell the difference when the two particles come together between trivial charge and non-trivial charge. And it's physically reasonable that we'd be able to do that. It means distinguishing between the case in which the particles can annihilate into the vacuum to phonons or something, and the case where there's some lump left behind which is unable to decay because it carries a non-zero value of a conserved charge. Well, conceivably, we could use a model with abelian anions to store quantum information as well. And actually, that was another one of Kitaev's ideas. He talked about, we've already heard a couple of times today, about his model of an emergent Z2 symmetry, which has Z2 fluxes and Z2 charges. And so we could imagine a planar surface with a lot of holes in it, and we could store quantum information in each hole by having a superposition of the state with a Z2 flux in the hole and no flux in the hole. So we could store a qubit in each one of the holes. But to make the information robust, in this case, we'd have to keep the holes large and far apart from one another. We want them to be large to suppress virtual processes in which charged particles wind around the holes, because that will contribute a relative phase to the two states which have a flux in the hole and the ones that don't have a flux in the hole. And we want to keep the holes far apart to suppress tunneling processes in which flux tunnels from one hole to another or from a hole to the edge of the sample. This information might be harder to read out than in the non-abelian case. We might do something like trying to contract the hole and see if there's some particle that appears, or do some kind of interference experiment, or maybe we'd find some clever way of mixing the Z2 with an electromagnetic U1, in which case we could, say, do some kind of Sentel Fisher experiment to detect the Z2 flux. Non-abelian anions are sort of intrinsically easier to read out, but the really important way in which they're different from the abelian case is that we can exploit topology not just to protect and store the quantum information, but also to process it. Now, an important thing about fusion, a mathematical ingredient in our model of anions, which is physically motivated, is that fusion is associative. So that means that if I have three particles, what I get doesn't depend on whether I fuse A and B first and then fuse the result with C, or fuse B and C first and then fuse the result with A. And therefore, when I consider the topological Hilbert space describing three particles with given charges which are fused together to give some specified total charge, there are two natural bases for that Hilbert space, two ways of expanding it in terms of the fusion spaces of two particles at a time, fusing these two first or fusing these two first. And those two unitary bases for the space are related by some unitary matrix, which I'm calling the F matrix. And there's another important isomorphism, which results from exchanging the particles. If I have two particles with label A and B, such that the total charge is C, and I perform a counterclockwise exchange of the two particles, that induces an isomorphism between this space where B and A are fused to give C and this space where A and B are fused to give C. And that's also described by some unitary matrix relating two bases, which I'm calling the R matrix. The R matrix determines not just the effects of exchanges, but also rotating particles by 2 pi. And the reason for that is shown here. If I consider a process in which I make a particle and an antiparticle, and then I exchange them and then annihilate them, that can be deformed to a process in which either the particle or the antiparticle rotates clockwise by 2 pi. So the topological spin representing a rotation by 2 pi is just the exchange phase picked up by exchanging a particle and an antiparticle with total charge 0. Okay, so let's recap where we are so far. We've understood what a model of non-abelian anions is. It has these ingredients: some finite label set, the possible values of the conserved charge, fusion rules, an F matrix expressing the associativity of fusion, and an R matrix which tells us what happens when we exchange neighboring particles where the total charge has a definite value. So what these determine is a representation of the mapping class group, that is, the group which is generated by exchanges of the neighboring particles and rotations by 2 pi. And these ingredients define a mathematical object which is called a unitary topological modular functor, which is almost the same thing as a topological quantum field theory. And it's related a little bit less closely to 1 plus 1 dimensional rational conformal field theory. Well, this is all very abstract stuff, so I want to talk about an example so that we can really understand what's going on. And an example that we want to consider at some length is what's known to the conformal field theorists as the Yang-Li model. I'm going to call it the Fibonacci model for a reason that you'll see in a minute. It's a non-abelian anion model, but it's about as simple as it could be. There's just one non-trivial charge, which I'm going to give the label 1. And there's one non-trivial fusion rule. When I fuse two particles, two things can happen. I can either get trivial charge so they can annihilate, or non-trivial charge, in which case they fuse to make a single anion. Well, that's the simplest conceivable non-abelian anion fusion rule, and yet it's already extremely interesting. And it was pointed out by the mathematician Greg Cooperberg in unpublished work that this is actually a model in which we can do universal quantum computing. Okay, so let's try to understand how we could label the states, or how we can find a basis for the topological vector space for n anyons in this model. Okay, so how will we do that? We'll make a standard basis by considering the n anyons and fusing them in a particular order. We fuse the two particles on the left, and we can get either a 0 or a 1. And we take the result, and we fuse that with the next particle, and we can get either a 0 or a 1, and so on, until finally the last particle fuses with whatever we had in the previous step, and we get a total charge of 0. So that means each one of these distinguishable states is labeled by a binary string, just telling me whether this intermediate state has labeled 0 or 1, and it's a string of length n minus 3 when we have n anyons with total charge 0. But not all binary strings can appear. There's a constraint because we can't get two zeros in a row. Because when a 0 fuses with the next 1, we have to get a 1. 0 fuses trivially with everything. We can't get a 0. So the states are actually labeled by binary strings with the constraint that you can't get two zeros in a row. And those are easy to count. And the numbers of them are Fibonacci numbers. That's why I'm calling it the Fibonacci model. That is, if I consider the dimension of the Hilbert space for n anyons, when n is equal to 4, 5, 6, 7, etc., the dimensions are the Fibonacci numbers, 2, 3, 5, 8, etc. Each one is the sum of the two preceding. Now, asymptotically, as the number of anyons gets large, the Fibonacci numbers grow like a power of the golden ratio 5. So that means the number of anyons, or the number of qubits, which is encoded per anyon, is actually just the log of the golden ratio. So there's about a little bit less than 7/10 of a qubit carried by each anyon. Well, that counting reminds us that the qubits are really a non-local property in the system. They're not sitting on top of one of the anyons. The topological Hilbert space doesn't have any particularly natural decomposition as a tensor product of qubits. In that sense, there's a non-locality in the topological Hilbert space which goes beyond the usual quantum non-locality. Okay, so I guess I forgot to say out loud that this number 5, we call it the quantum dimension of this anyon because it controls how quickly the dimension of the topological Hilbert space grows as we add anyons, a power of 5 for each anyon. And this idea of the quantum dimension is an important one in the theory, so I'd like to discuss it a little bit more. How can we define a quantum dimension for an arbitrary anyon? Well, here's a way we can do it. We can consider a process in which we make two particle-antiparticle pairs of type A. And then we fuse together the particle from the pair on the left and the antiparticle from the pair on the right. Will those annihilate one another or not? Well, there's some amplitude for the annihilation to occur, and I'm going to call that 1 over D, where D is the quantum dimension of the anyon of type A. That's a natural way of generalizing the dimension. If you think about the case where the charge is just the irreducible representation of some group, where the dimension is the dimension of the representation, in effect it counts the number of colors that are going around the loop, and because there are two loops here and just one loop here, they differ by a factor of 1 over D. But there's no logical reason why a dimension defined in this way has to be 1 over an integer, or why the dimension has to be an integer, and in general, it's not. Now, what does this dimension have to do with the counting of dimensions of topological Hilbert spaces I was referring to a minute ago? Well, we can see the connection more easily if we use a different way of normalizing these diagrams. If I consider a process in which we make a lot of particle-antiparticle pairs and annihilate them, I can think of that as a world line of a particle that zigzags in space-time. And each time I add another tooth to the saw, that costs me another factor of 1 over dA. And if I want to avoid that, I can change the normalization, weighting each one of the pair creation events and each one of the pair annihilation events by a square root of d. And what that means is that a closed loop will be weighted by d. So this is the same thing as the isotopic dimension that we've been hearing about. The advantage of this normalization is that now I can deform the world line and add zigs and zags or take them away without changing the value of a diagram. So now I can deform the diagrams, and they have a kind of topological invariance. Now here's how we can use that to learn something. The product of the dimension of A and B is just represented by an A loop and a B loop. And I can insert a sum over intermediate states all the ways in which A and B can fuse to give the label C and a basis for the fusion states that can occur when A and B go to C. But now I can take this diagram and I can turn it inside out because I can deform it any way I want and put the C loop on the outside and then shrink the fusion states. But I get a factor which counts the number of fusion states, which is this element of the fusion rules, and then I have a C loop, and that's just a factor of DC. Okay? So in our Fibonacci model, we would get an equation since we have two non-trivial charges can give either trivial or non-trivial, which is D squared equals D plus 1, and the solution to that is the golden ratio. But this is a way we can see there's a general connection between the fusion rules and the dimensions. And another way of interpreting this equation is that I can think of the fusion rule as a matrix, and the vector whose components are the dimensions of all the particles is an eigenstate of each one of these matrices with an eigenvalue which is given by the dimension. And that's how we see the connection with counting states. Because I can diagonalize the fusion rules and write it as its eigenvector with the largest eigenvalue, if this turns out to be the largest eigenvalue, plus other stuff. And then when I count up all the intermediate states that can occur in this standard basis, when I combine together n particles of type A to give total charge B, counting is just multiplying these matrices, and so I wind up with a matrix element of the n minus first power of nA, the fusion rule for particles of type A, sandwiched between a B on one side and an A on the other. And if I normalize this eigenvector, I get this formula, which is correct up to some sub-leading piece, which comes from the power of the non-leading eigenvector. So this is a good formula asymptotically. And it goes like the dimension of particle A to the nth power. So we see why the size of the Hilbert space grows like that. And the normalization that comes in here is called the total dimension of the theory, which is just the square root of the sums of the squares of the dimensions, what came into normalizing this vector. Okay. Well, this quantum dimension, since we kept hearing about isotopic dimension, I'll say another thing about it, which is kind of fun. We can use the same argument, slightly generalized, to analyze this situation in which I make a pair of type B and a pair of type A, and then fuse together the A and the B. What's the probability of getting C? It's the same kind of diagram again, but where now I don't sum over C. I have a projector that fixes the value of C, which I can now deform to this diagram again, except now there's no sum over C over here. And if I divide by the DADB to normalize it, I get a formula for the probability that I get C when I fuse A and B, which involves the dimensions and the fusion rules. And now suppose we imagine a process where I quench the system or something and make a very dense gas with lots of anions with some arbitrary initial distribution of particle types. But then I let most of the defects anneal. They bump into one another and fuse into anions of new types. And the probability distribution for the different types then is going to converge to a steady state distribution, which solves this equation, that the probability summed against this transition probability has to equal PC. That's the steady state distribution. And I can solve that equation and find that the probability of a particle being a type A is proportional to the square of the quantum dimension. Okay? So when you, in some random process, make a state of lots of anions, you'll find that ones of higher dimension are more likely to occur because you have more states that way, effectively. Okay. So now I want to use this standard basis I told you about, where I look at the anions and I fuse them, starting on the left and then the next one and then the next one. Look at the intermediate states that arise. That gives me a way of labeling the basis states of this topological vector space. And I want to know what the effect of braiding is in this basis. And that defines another unitary matrix, which I'm calling the B matrix. But all I want to point out is that the B matrix is nothing new. We already know how to compute it from the stuff we knew about the F and the R, because I can take the standard basis and I can make this F move to change to a basis where the particles being exchanged have some definite charge. The R matrix tells us what happens when we do the exchange, and then I can invert the F move to go back to the standard basis. So once I've defined the F matrix and the R matrix, I know braiding in this basis. And that's why I said it actually defines a representation of the braid group and, in fact, the mapping class group. Okay, so I remind you again what a quantum computation is. I told you already. You make a bunch of pairs, you braid them in some way, and then you bring them together in pairs and you ask whether the pairs annihilate or not to read out the result. Well, the first comment I want to make is that this three-step process, creating pairs, executing a braid, and fusing pairs, that's something that we can efficiently simulate with a quantum circuit. So any quantum computer that you like to use, you can use to simulate this process. And to understand that, we just have to explain these things. First of all, we have to understand how to encode the topological Hilbert space using ordinary qubits. Then we have to say how the effect of braiding, this B matrix, can be represented as a gate acting on that encoding. And then we have to say how we simulate the fusion to observe whether the pairs at the end are able to annihilate or not. But the key idea is just this, that although each one of these topological vector spaces has no particularly natural decomposition as a tensor product of small subsystems, there is such a tensor product that contains all of them. What I can consider is a tensor product of n minus 2 d-dimensional systems, qdits, if you like, where each qdit is just the complete fusion space that is spanned by all the possible ways in which three particles can fuse together to give the trivial charge. Okay, all of these guys fit into that space. And so that's how, and I can represent a qdit by qubits if I want to. So that's how I'm going to encode the state of the topological quantum computer. And then when I do an exchange of two neighboring particles, which is what I need to do to generate the braid group, that's this B matrix, which just acts on two neighboring qubits in the line. So that's simple to do on a quantum computer. And the final fusion is just a two qdit measurement, which is also efficiently done on a quantum computer. So the point of all that is just that the topological model, although it has a certain strange non-locality, which seems to go beyond the usual quantum computing model, is no more powerful from a complexity theory point of view. Anything that we can do on a topological quantum computer, we could in principle do with any other universal quantum computer. But is it as powerful? The question we want to address is, can we use a topological quantum computer to simulate, is it 10? Yeah. To simulate an arbitrary quantum computation? And the answer to that question actually depends on the model, and in particular on the representation of the braid group defined by this R matrix and this F matrix. So the question is really whether we can find some way of encoding qubits in the topological vector spaces so that the representation of the braid group that we obtain when we exchange the particles will actually be dense in unitary transformations on some space which is a tensor product of a number of qubits, which scales linearly with the number of anions. So first of all, the encoding. Let's go back to the Fibonacci model. There's a simple way of encoding a qubit in four anions, because if I have four anions and they're combined together to give a total charge of zero, there are two distinguishable ways of doing that. This intermediate state can either be zero or one. That's a qubit. Okay, so that solves the problem of encoding qubits. But to know what the braiding properties are, I have to know what R and F are. And how am I supposed to figure that out if all we know so far is the fusion rules? Well, it actually turns out that the R matrix defining braiding and the F matrix reflecting associativity of fusing are very, very highly constrained by algebraic consistency conditions, what in conformal field theory are called the Moore-Seiberg polynomial equations, and they arise in the same way here. And in fact, in the Fibonacci model, those equations are sufficient to completely determine R and F and tell us everything about the model once we know the fusion rules. So the idea of the consistency condition is this: I can consider making F moves and R moves, which take me from a basis for one topological Hilbert space to a basis for another topological Hilbert space, and consider a sequence of such moves which take me from some initial basis to some final basis. And there may be various paths I can take to get from that initial basis to the final basis, but all of them have to define the same isomorphism. They all define the same relation between the initial and final basis. So for example, if I have five particles, or rather four particles, and I consider fusing them together to give a total charge that's specified, I can consider these two standard bases where I fuse the particles two at a time starting on the left, or this standard basis where I fuse them two at a time starting on the right, and I can make F moves to get from one basis to the other, either going this way across the top of the pentagon or this way across the bottom of the pentagon. And those two paths have to define the same isomorphism, and that's how I get a consistency condition on the F matrix, reflecting associativity, and this is actually what it looks like if you write it out. And similarly, if I consider three particles, which are fused together to give some definite total charge, I can consider these two bases where the particles are ordered 1, 2, 3, and I fuse the two on the left first, or this basis where they're ordered 2, 3, 1, and I fuse the two on the right first. And there are two different ways of getting from the basis on the left to the basis on the right by alternating F moves and R moves, the top of the hexagon and the bottom of the hexagon, and those have to agree, and that gives me a consistency condition on F and R called the hexagon equation, and this is what it looks like. Now, the really beautiful thing is that once the hexagon equation and the pentagon equation are satisfied, there are no further consistency conditions. You can actually show that if those conditions are satisfied, then for any two paths from one basis for a topological Hilbert space to another basis for another topological Hilbert space induced by a sequence of R and F moves, all those different paths give the same isomorphism if these equations are satisfied. So that means we have a systematic way in principle of constructing what we could call an anion model, which is, first of all, assume a fusion rule, and then see if you can solve the pentagon and hexagon equations and determine R and F. And you might find that no solutions are possible, and that means the fusion rules you hypothesize are not possible. They're not compatible with the other principles of local quantum physics. If you find one solution, that's good. If you find more than one, and they're really not related to one another by a change of variable, then they're really two or more distinct models, all with the same fusion rules. In the case of the Fibonacci model, the solution does turn out to be unique. We have one non-trivial F matrix, which just expresses there are two ways of fusing three anions to get total charge 1, labeled by this A, which can be 0 or 1, and that defines a 2 by 2 F matrix. And there are two eigenvalues for the R matrix, because I can exchange two anions whose total charge can be either 0 or 1. You solve the pentagon and hexagon equations, and you find that the eigenvalues of R are determined to be fifth roots of unity, and F is this nice unitary matrix whose entries are tau and the square root of tau, where tau is just one, the golden ratio minus 1. The golden ratio is all over the place in this model. And the solution is unique in that the only freedom we have is to redefine phases or to take the parity conjugate, which would complex conjugate R. But furthermore, if I now consider the representation I get of the three-particle braid group, which is generated by the exchange of particles 1 the two particles on the left and the exchange of the two particles on the right, those are non-commuting matrices, and their action is dense in SU2. So by composing those two exchanges together, I can get as close as I want to anything in the SU2 spanned by this index A in the standard basis. Okay, so now I can say how we would simulate a quantum circuit with this model. I've already said we'll encode qubits using four anions with total charge 0, which can be fused to give total charge 0 in two distinguishable ways. We want to simulate a quantum circuit, and that means we need to do a series of two-qubit gates, which we can take to be two-qubit gates acting on the neighboring qubits. Well, if I look at two qubits, that's actually encoded now in an 8-anion Hilbert space, which is 13-dimensional. It's one of these Fibonacci numbers. I'm trying to do some two-qubit gate, which is an element of SU4 acting in our code space. But in fact, it turns out that R and F matrix that we found for the Fibonacci model, when we consider exchanges of neighbors for 8 anions, it's dense in SU13. So in particular, I can get as close as I want to anything in SU4, which is the 2-qubit gate acting on our code space. Okay? So with some finite number of exchanges, I can approximate to any accuracy I want the 2-qubit gate, which is part of the gate set alphabet for the universal quantum computer I'm trying to simulate. There may be small errors if I stick with some finite accuracy in my implementation of the gate, and we know how to take care of those using quantum error correction ideas. But what's different here is that while we might still want to use quantum error correction to correct for small inaccuracies in the gate, we wouldn't need it to fight off the effects of environmental decoherence. There's also an issue of leakage, that is, the problem that the qubits might drift away from the code space. Well, I won't discuss this in detail because I think I'm running short of time. Let me just say that there's a known way in the theory of quantum fault tolerance for dealing with the problem that the state can leak away from a code space, and we can apply that here. Okay, so to summarize, we've seen that we can simulate a universal quantum computer using, and I've only talked about the simplest example, the Fibonacci anyons, which turns out to work. And we're assuming that we have these physical capabilities, that we're able to create pairs of particles, that we can guide the particles along a specified braid, and we can fuse the particles together and tell the difference between whether they annihilate completely or leave a particle behind. It's implicit that the temperature is small compared to the energy gap, so there aren't a lot of thermally excited anions drifting around, and that we keep the anions sufficiently far apart from one another that we don't have to worry about unwanted charge-changing exchange processes between the anions, except when we create the pairs, when we initialize the computer, and when we fuse them, when we read out the final result. So we've seen how to characterize an anion model in terms of its label set, its fusion rules, its F matrix, and an R matrix. And classifying anion models really means finding all the solutions to the pentagon and hexagon equations, all the solutions to these polynomial constraints. And that's an unsolved mathematical problem. We do have methods for constructing lots of examples, and we've been hearing about them from Mike and Chaitan, using ideas from Chern-Simons theory, for example, but we don't really know what the whole universe of anion models looks like. And that's an interesting problem from the point of view of condensed matter physics, because it's an important step toward classifying topological order in two dimensions. But even it wouldn't be the whole story. Even if we knew all the anion models, I've been describing the bulk models, the properties of in gapped phases of particles in the bulk, but it's actually possible that two different anion models which have the same bulk properties could behave differently on the edge, and part of the complete classification would be knowing what edge theories correspond, because there could be more than one, with each one of the bulk theories, which that is, with each possible solution to the pentagon and hexagon equations for a specified fusion rule. And of course, what we really like to know, both for practical and theoretical reasons, is whether and how these models can be realized robustly with some local Hamiltonian, and that's what you've heard about today from other speakers. There are two types of approaches that have been discussed recently, that ideas about implementation. One I already sort of mentioned in passing, originally suggested by Yaffe and Feigelman and collaborators, and initially with the idea in mind of realizing these abelian quantum memories using Josephson junction arrays. And another idea, which looks exciting, is to use the properties of cold atoms trapped in optical lattices, where in principle we have the power to realize designer materials. And in particular, Dwan, Lucan, and Demler have discussed how using cold atoms we might be able to realize one of the models that Kataev constructed, which is known to have non-abelian anion. So that's something that I hope we'll be hearing more about later in the week from Eugene and others. And thanks a lot for your attention.
Okay, I understand why it's important to establish that a topological quantum computer is equivalent to an old-fashioned qubit computer.
Mm-hmm.
So they're isomorphic as up to power law.
Right.
But presumably, if you're actually going to program a quantum computer, you wouldn't do it this way. You'd find some more clever thing that was suited to this hardware as opposed to...
Yeah, no, sure. And I mean,
has any thought been given?
Well, not a whole lot, a little. I mean, so you're asking, David Gross, that well-known engineer, is asking the question, how would we adapt software design to the peculiarities of our hardware?
Well, since you have no hardware of any kind,
right?
Why go through the qubit phase? I mean,
I understand what you're saying. You're saying, I mean, as you as you made clear in the preface to your question, you understand why it's important to know they're the same, because it's nice to know there's really just one computational model that we're all talking about. But you're saying, why should I, once I have a topological quantum computer, try to use it by taking some program that somebody wrote down for a qubit computer and translating it into, using software, you know, into the machine language? Yeah, maybe I don't have to do that. And indeed, I haven't thought much about this. If I have a particular representation of the Braid group, and I want to do interesting computations with minimal resources, like let's say a minimal number of exchanges, then I should really start from scratch and use the gate set that I have.
Just a quick comment on David's question. I asked Mike Friedman, who has left, specifically that question. And I specifically asked, for example, Shor's algorithm, there must be a way of doing, and this was his answer. But that's such a boring question. I don't want to spend my time on that. my question, the Young-Lee model, are there any even remote physical realizations of that?
Not that I am familiar with.
But is anybody familiar with that? Because it's such a neat model.
I don't know, this Young-Lee model is a subset of SU2 level 3 transition.
Oh yeah, well, maybe I should have said that. Okay.
And that one have, there's an abelian quantum host that SU2 level 3
right. Can be. So I should have made clear that really what, in the paper that I referred to by Friedman, Larson, and Wang, actually they talked about SU2 at level k equals 3, which has very similar properties. This is just a stripped down minimal version, if you like. I've gotten rid of some extraneous junk which is in SU2 level 3 that we don't need and kept what's important, and the result is the Young-Lee model.
No, that I understand. Yeah. Because in quantum Hall system we have realizations of that principle. But I was asking specifically about the Young-Lee.
Yeah, I don't know.
This classification problem you mentioned at the end, is it the same as, easier, harder than classifying all rational conformal field theories in two dimensions?
I think it's essentially the same. Yeah, because there too you would, the challenge would be to find all the solutions of the pentagon and hexagon.
Because in the 80s people thought a lot about that and essentially gave up post-Moore Seiberg, which under the guys, well, we know all the ones we know and we're okay with that.
Right. Okay. But I guess I'm not saying that it's time to revisit the question, but I am saying that we should recognize that it's an extremely relevant classification for understanding topological order in two dimensions, which may not have been so clear to those people in the 80s who were thinking about it.
No more questions? Well, thanks for being here.